Welcome to the Hello First Name Podcast. The Hello First Name Podcast revolves around the term personalization and is brought to you by marketing author Rasmus Holin, founder of Omnichannel Institute and chief experience officer at the marketing automation software company Agilic. The podcast is based on the book Hello First Name. Each episode is based in turn on a chapter from the book, followed by a discussion of the very same chapter with an expert marketing practitioner in the following episode. As always, you can buy the book on Amazon or other bookstores. You can also choose to listen to it all for free on your favorite podcast service. You're also very welcome to download the abstract of the book for free, and all models, of course, are able to download. All downloads are sponsored by Agilic. I'll make sure to put a link to everything in the show notes. But you can always connect on LinkedIn, and I'll be happy to reply and help out. Hello, and welcome to the Hello First Name podcast. Today, we'll be discussing chapter 15 from the book Hello First Name. The chapter is called The Basic Foundations for Personalization. But I think you could also call it Things You Need to Do as an Organization Before Doubling Down and Investing Heavily in Personalization. Maybe I'll put that in the next revision of the book. I'm very, very happy and proud to have Jesper Damsgaard, newly appointed SVP of e-commerce at Pandora, with me in the studio. Jesper, welcome.
Thank you so much, Rasmus, and thank you so much for writing the book as well. I have it here with me. Yeah. I really enjoyed reading it, so I'm very happy to be on the podcast as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words. Jesper, you've been working at Pandora for some years now, and before that you were in Boston Consulting Group. Mm-hmm. In your own words, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your career?
Sure. So going all the way back to my studies, I actually studied finance, even though I've never really worked with it then afterwards. Mm. I then had a few years at the Boston Consulting Group, indeed, which was a great start for a new kid like me, learning tools of the trade, mainly focusing on the key commercial topics, so pricing, sales, merchandising, and marketing, yeah, as well, for the clients that we were serving mainly across Europe. And then around 8 years ago, actually now, so close to a decade.
Time flies.
Exactly, time flies when you're having fun. I started working for Pandora. Mm. And then after a while, I realized that there was no need for me to be a consultant anymore. I might as well join them because I enjoyed it so much. Yeah. I really loved the culture there, and I still do. And I have been working there ever since then, basically across many different roles by now. But for the last 7 or so years in the marketing department across everything that we do there. And it has been a truly fantastic journey to be part of.
And for the people who may not know Pandora, mm-hmm, can you say a few words on Pandora, the product, yeah, maybe the business model, how you go to market and which markets you operate in?
I mean, it's starting to change a little bit now, but overall, I've always felt that Pandora is such an untold story in specifically the Danish business landscape.
Interesting.
Pandora is the world's largest jewelry brand. Not everyone knows that. We produce and sell more than 100 million pieces of jewelry that are handcrafted in our own facilities in Thailand every year. And wow, we mainly sell through our own channels all across the world, our own store, our own e-store. We also have partners, but the majority of our sales come through our own channel. Our biggest markets are the US, UK, Italy, Germany, but we're also seeing more and more sales coming from more developing markets in Latin America. China obviously is big for us, so it's a truly global business. Yeah,
so real omnichannel. I remember speaking at your big marketing event here in, I think it was September or October, which was a pretty impressive setup, I must say. So so thank you for that also.
Yeah,
so the product you sell, you say jewelry, but the way that I know Pandora is a lot about the charms.
Yeah.
And I don't know how big a part that still plays, but is it fair to say that that's still sort of part of the assortment?
Of course, that's our bread and butter. That is the charms. I mean, now we're going to talk about personalization, of course, today.
Yeah.
And the charms in that context are extremely interesting because at the core of it, of course, it is a personalized proposition that we
are like small beads that you put together on a string, right? Yeah,
exactly. So we like to say that consumers can tell their story with our jewelry. They use our jewelry to express who they are. in general, the jewelry category is very emotional. It's a very meaningful jewelry category. Most jewelry that you buy is tied to a moment in time, something you want to remember, something you want to express about yourself or your personality. And the core proposition of Pandora, which is the Moments Charms and bracelets, taps directly into that and has been a hugely successful proposition for us. We do see more and more sales coming as well from the other jewelry categories. That's part of what's driving our growth right now. But the core of the brand, you can say, is that meaningfulness, which is sort of most easily expressed through our charms and bracelets. Yeah.
It's also, I think it's a beautiful purpose because, I mean, just selling whatever jewelry so people can look more posh than they did before.
Yeah.
I think some would think that that's a sort of a so-so purpose to have.
Yeah.
But the thing about the meaningfulness that people ascribe to the things that they buy and the gifts that they give and all the love and the feelings and the emotions they put into it, I think that's really beautiful.
I mean, we like to think that ourselves as well. But you are indeed very right. And when I travel around the world and meet consumers everywhere, you get to hear a lot of very emotional stories. The bond that people have with the jewelry is truly something. So we like to think of that as something that differentiates us in the market, which is also why our purpose is giving a voice to people's loves. So whoever you are, whatever you love, you can express that through our jewelry and you can become more of yourself. While other jewelry brands, you might want to tap into a dream and express something different about who you are, we truly believe that we can amplify your personality and your personal expression with our jewelry. So that's what we try and communicate about. Yeah. And it's also one of the core reasons why personalization is such a great fit for Pandora as a company. But I'm sure we'll get back to that.
It just reminds me of Interflora, the flower gifting company, where actually the message and the greeting card and the love that you send with it means more than the flowers, because the flowers wither away quickly, but the emotions and the card maybe remain.
Yeah.
And that's really much more essential than whether the flower bouquet was red or black or whatever.
That's true. Another thing we have in common there is that we have a very high share of gifting. Of course, and we have the majority of our business around big occasions. Again, less and less so, but still, that is true for us as well. Yeah.
All right. I think we'll get back to that. So when I'm looking at the different roles that you had at Pandora, I both see, and this is part of the reason why I'm so happy that you said yes to go come to the show here. I see both like branding and consumer insight roles, and how much of that is related to first party data and how much is that is related to sort of in market data. And so where, if you can say, there's a scale from building brands and brand awareness and brand perception towards, you know, converting, so to speak, where would you say you've been in the across that spectrum?
I've been doing both, actually. And I think one of the core points is that as a brand, you need to do both very well.
Yeah.
Personalization and, let's say, performance marketing optimization has been very hyped for many years, especially with the new technologies coming out. And it is extremely important. But if you don't do proper upper funnel demand generating marketing, then you are nowhere. You need to do both. When I meet and talk with other marketing colleagues, I talk with a lot of pure online players, for example, that are brilliant at the more personalized level, but lack true skills when it comes to the upper funnel brand building part of the job. And you have other brands, legacy brands, with exactly the opposite problem. So I think more and more the consensus is actually that you need to be great at both. And I've been trying to, throughout my career, therefore, be exposed to both disciplines, you can say. Yeah.
And I think that's actually a movement at the time, right? That people are starting to realize more and more that, okay, just because you can measure performance marketing more easily doesn't mean that you don't have to do brand awareness campaigns and big brand campaigns, which are harder to measure by nature. Still equally important. And maybe especially in times when people are short of money, because, I mean, you cannot sell to people who cannot buy. So what can you do then? You can build a relationship. So as soon as they get the money, you have the brand preference. And you may even have bought it at a bargain because there weren't that many people bidding for the ads at that particular time.
Yeah, definitely.
So, so which types of personalization? I think that's and this big question, obviously. But yeah. if you which types of personalization are you using at Pandora? I'm thinking about campaigns, obviously, both on brand building and a more performance level of campaigns, owned versus paid media, marketing automation on site. Which of these are you working with at Pandora?
So. Again, when I talk with a lot of my colleagues, they're very jealous of me because I'm so lucky to have access to so much data. But it didn't come by coincidence. It's a specific part of our strategy agreed many, many years ago that we want to ourselves, for the majority part, own our distribution channels where it makes sense for a few different reasons. Of course, there's some financial calculations behind it, but a large share of the reason why we want to do that is to control the brand experience and to get more first-party data. And I'm very lucky also to work with a CEO that really appreciates the importance of first-party data for the long-term success of the company. And I think all CEOs should recognize that as a strategic priority. So we, as I mentioned, have a lot of sales through our own channel, both physical and the online channel that I'm heading up. And now we have more than 700 million people visiting us every year that we get information from. And we use that to try and personalize the journey across all of our channels. We're more advanced in some than others. It's easier for us to do great personalization in email, as an example. So we started really with that as a spearhead to generate some positive results, to generate some revenue for us as well that paid back on some of the back-end investments that we needed to make to fix the data, to fix the magic. So that's what we have been doing. But over time, we've sort of been building up more and more capabilities within sort of true cross-channel orchestration as well, all the way out into the physical channel, even though that is more difficult and we're still working on it.
Yeah, I think getting the physical channel and the clienteling, getting that to work, I think that is that's not an easy task because there's so many moving parts. I was talking actually to one of your former colleagues slash employees who was part of that some years ago. And he said that it was, I mean, you could develop the perfect clienteling app and have it installed on whatever device and so on. But then you find out that suddenly there's a store where they don't have internet access. And what do you do then? Or it will take you forever for IT to come and repair if things get broken or whatever. So there's a whole separate supply chain on getting the clienteling to work.
Yeah, and I mean, also the ones that are best at clienteling are also oftentimes companies with, few high price point sales taking place. Yeah. We have many transactions happening, you know, every 11 minutes or so in our stores. We need to sell 100 million of pieces of jewelry every day. So store staff don't have that much time to spend hours engaging with customers through a clienteling system necessarily. Of course, some of that can be automated, and that's part of what we are working on. But it's not so easy as you see in luxury, which is a higher engagement category than what we're playing.
All right. Let's move on a bit. Yeah. It seems like you're covering the whole palette there of, I mean, both automation and emails and paid and owned. But I'm assuming that on the branding perspective, you're not personalizing so much.
I mean, correct. It depends option. A little bit on your definition, of course. But no, it is true that to a large degree, the starting point for us is to do beautiful, you know, demand generating campaigns, upper funnel campaigns that makes the Pandora brand irresistible for our consumers, selling them a dream. Yeah. Once they then come in to our store, whether that's online or offline, that is for me more where personalization plays a role in terms of them saying, okay, you came here for the brand, but we have a breadth actually of different propositions available for you that we can then serve up for you. In the past, we have experimented with also, you can say, building up more personalized propositions, more upper funnel marketing and communication. And the challenge with that is it becomes, for example, very expensive if you start splitting that up. You don't really achieve the scale and the mass awareness levels that we need to drive a mass business. As what we are doing. So we try and really keep that lean. We invest a lot of money in making those assets look as beautiful as possible So it's a slightly different game. It's also a different timeline. It's a different process than the one we use to drive personalization, where we employ a much more agile, much faster process to be able to respond to trends. That's not what we are doing with the upper funnel communication.
I mean, that totally aligns with what I've experienced. I mean, the brand core story is the brand core story. You don't need 100 versions of that.
No.
On the other hand, it could be, I mean, you're a global company. So, and if you're wanting to sell the dream could look differently if you were on the Southern Hemisphere in an Islamic country than if you were in the US. Or in. So there could be some localization issues, I would assume, with the brand story or...
To a degree, but the need that we are talking about in our brain story is it's based on a core human need for self-expression. And every person in the world has that need, and it's a core need for them. So how that then comes and is is actually then expressed can be different by different market. But if you really get into the core of it, and I believe this to be true, if you want to be a mass brand, you need to really touch something very human, very fundamental that you're talking into. And that message should work across the majority of the cultures, whether it's love, whether it's happiness, whether it's self-expression or whatever it is. So we are not actually changing that much if you look at our upper funnel communication across markets. It's a core basic human need that we are trying to touch to a large degree. When you didn't get into the execution of it, of course, there are some nuances that we need to take into account, the different channels, different players, but sort of that core insight and that core positioning around meaningfulness, identity, and self-expression is the same across our markets globally. And we run the same TV commercial all around the world. We don't shoot different ones.
Okay. So in an earlier episode, I mean, it makes sense because in an earlier episode, I had a neuroscientist called Matt Johnson, if I don't remember it wrongly. And he was talking about, and we were discussing actually why personalization works. And I think it comes down to also the sort of the basic stuff about why does marketing work in the first place. And the reason it works is because if you can address some of the fundamental motives, this thing called the fundamental motive framework, where we as human beings have, I mean, as soon as you're done with, you know, having sleep and something to eat and you can reproduce and whatever, then sort of the basic needs from the Maslowian pyramid are covered. And then come the like fundamental motives where you want to be socially accepted, you want to not get ill, you want to avoid harm, and you want to avoid bankruptcy and so on and so on. So I think basically what I hear you say is that you basically distill it down until you have something that is so close to a fundamental motive that it can work for basically all over the world.
That's correct. And then we test it rigorously with both quant and qual testing. We do that with all the big campaigns that we do. So we are not just guessing that it works around the world. We know that it connects with people all around the world. And if it doesn't, then we might need to do smaller tweaks. But again, if the idea is good enough, if the fundamental insight is good enough, then it works very broadly with all humans.
Interesting. So chapter is called... the prerequisites for personalization. In your opinion, can you start with personalization too early as a company?
I think I would say yes and no. And the reason is, I think you need to always, you cannot start thinking about personalization too early. This is my own perspective, by the way. And I'm talking a little bit about this differently than you do in the book. It's not that I disagree with it. I just think about it maybe slightly differently. Yeah. I don't think you can start thinking about personalization actually too early if you are a senior executive in a company today. You need to have it on your radar. But that does not mean that you need to place all your bets in personalization and becoming a world champion in it from day one. There are different factors that make it more difficult for different companies. It can be quite expensive to do as well. So you could end up in a situation, if you don't do it right, where you invest a lot of money in it and don't see the benefit or the return that you would like, and you could have spent that money, time, and resources in a better way.
So opening new stores or whatever.
It could be so many different things. One of the things you're mentioning as well in the book is that you need to be somewhat established, right? You need to have a working website, as an example. You need to check out
the cash register first.
I mean, there could be many things. If your website is very, very slow, I would probably fix that before I started doing personalization. So once you are at sort of a basic level of in some of those things, but then I will start thinking about it actually relatively early. Also, again, there are some channels where it doesn't make sense to wait. In a way, you need to do it when it comes to your website to a degree. You need to do it in email when it comes to a degree. And just having that mindset, I think you can do a lot no matter what your starting point is actually from a bigger data perspective. Yeah. You can always find a use case to just get going very early on. Yeah.
And also with in the book Hello First Name, with a very broad definition of personalization, I think there's almost no way that you can even place an ad today without having a thought about, okay, so which segment are we trying to, which audience are we trying to get in front of here?
Yeah, we've had that discussion as well. What's the difference between targeting and personalization? Yeah. And it becomes, for me at least, somewhat academic in a way.
It does.
If I'm reacting to a signal that the customer sends to me or one of my partners, if I don't own the data myself directly, then for me that's personalization. And like you're saying, you can't buy an ad today without having a framework and thinking through that. So it's exactly the same way that I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. We have operationalized it at Pandora. Yeah.
Good to hear. So other things that what needs to be in place before really, I mean, think about it, you say, as a senior executive and consider it and have it sort of on your radar. But in order to really make it take off, in your regard, what would need to be in place?
Yeah. So a few things that comes to mind when you ask the question. First of all, you need to know what your brand stands for. Part of what could go wrong with personalization, as I mentioned, and some of the pure players that are very strong in this instance, I believe, have this problem actually, is that you fragment your communication too much. You end up putting spin behind assets that are not overall on brand or building the brand. And you end up with not being, maybe you are very relevant for the individual, but you're not fundamentally building up equity and demand behind your core brand, your core proposition in the market. So you need to know what your brand stands for so that you know what personalization sort of doesn't cross that line and becomes off-brand. It needs to build towards something bigger in the future. You need to build sort of a core proposition that sort of works. I think secondly, you need to have a view on your data. You need to have a data strategy. Doesn't mean you need to have tons of data necessarily in place in the beginning. You can do a lot through partners. You can do a lot with very little data. I mean, the first click you do on a website tells you quite a lot about the intent of that customer visiting. But you do need to have sort of a view on where you are today, where you want to go in the future, and what can you start off sort of gathering, and how will you build up more data to use for personalization in the future. And then I think lastly and most importantly, you need to have the right people in place and the right buy-in for the senior executive leadership. Yeah. Because this is not something that you do overnight. It will require resources. It will require investments. It will require time. So if you don't have that buy-in and you don't have the right people to help drive that agenda internally, again, you end up hitting against the wall, your head against the wall too much, because it's not easy to do this.
I haven't seen any personalization yet that personalizes itself or any automation that automates itself. I mean, we can talk about Gen AI, generative AI and stuff, but really I haven't seen anything build itself or run on autopilot from A to Z. So having the human resources and the buy-in to get those resources, probably pretty. So actually, what comes to mind right now is that I think we're talking about working with personalization. And I think what you're talking about here, you know, getting the right people on board, that's also working with personalization, because you need to find people who can understand it. And working with data, not necessarily using it yet, but just thinking into your campaigns and into your touch points and your website and so on, that you need to collect data. Maybe not for now, but you need to, until you have like a decent pool of data where the juice would be worth the squeeze for any personalized campaign you would do, you need some kind of volume for that. How quick does that come? How quick does that volume come, you think?
I mean, for Pandora, very quick, because we are such a big company.
Yeah, luckily.
It takes time. It takes time, right? So I'm very happy for some of the decisions that we made many years ago, or that some of my predecessors made years ago, because it means that today we are sitting on a huge database of very valuable data. Now, we still have more work to do, but at least we have a very good starting point. I think the time period it takes potentially also depends on your frequency of visits.
Obviously.
So the Pandora people visit or buy from us roughly, let's say, 1 to 1.2, 1.3 times a year. So it's not that frequently, actually, people buy from us. Now, of course, some people engage with us much more frequently than they buy with us. But it's not like selling coffee, let's say. Selling
that's Jilix demo concept. That's a so, Cafe Connect.
There you go. Something else. There you can build up a richer data set faster than with us. For me to calculate, how many charms that does a customer buy before they start churning or whatever, take years. I need to capture years of data around that same customer to see how they develop over their lifetime with us. So that is a longer term investment that you need to make.
Which data sources do you have for collecting first party data? I guess you're also into, wow, we need to have as much first party data as we want, and luckily some thought of that also before you joined, so you actually do have quite a pool. Which sources do you have?
I mean, first of all, I will say a lot of things are happening within data capture, of course, also when it comes to data privacy. As a company, we take data privacy very seriously, and we invest quite a lot in making sure that the customer feels that they get something in return when they give us some data. So if our experience is if the customer sees this as being valuable, then they are okay with it. Yeah. But it actually starts again with sort of understanding the customer and understanding what do they want in return for that data, and what data do we need to capture in order to actually deliver that experience to the customer. So for me, it's not so much about necessarily getting as much data as possible, but getting the right data, which is why I'm saying you need to be clear about what are the use cases that you want to execute to build your data strategy to get started and get the snowball rolling in all of this. It starts off with what is the core experience you want to give to your customers, and how can we sort of make that value exchange work in one way or the other.
And then you think backwards, you reverse engineer which kind of data you need depending on which customer journey you want to create,
and with what latency and all kinds of other things. And then once you have that in place, we are quite lucky, we can capture it. So we own more than 3,000 stores all around the world, so we capture data from our physical stores around the purchases that our consumers are doing, and we also capture other data that we're not necessarily utilizing at sort of a mass scale, let's say, but we do capture other data in our stores as well, where it's allowed. And then, of course, online, our website is a huge source of data. It can both browsing behavior data and purchase data. And then we have very good working relationships as well with some of our stakeholders that we work with quite a lot, mainly Meta and Google, where we can use them to do great targeting / personalization, if you want to call it that. So we have a relatively large rich set of data. Then recently, one of the things I have been developing as well is a new loyalty system. We realized a few years back that we needed that. So we are currently rolling that out as well to our core market. So we make that value exchange even more prominent for our customers, that they can sign up to a loyalty program with us. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And we use that to gather information through gamification. You can ask questions. We found, for example, that people are quite willing, again, to share information with us if they get just a little bit in return. It could be a few points. It could be, something. But just recognizing that the customer is actually giving you something already means a lot.
I think you are totally right. Sounds almost as if you have like the complete picture of each customer. One of the points that I at least try to make in the book is that the customer journey belongs basically to each and every customer. Mm-hmm. So no matter how much data almost that we collect and how well we are at, crunching it and doing algorithms and so on, we basically don't know what's going on in the lives of the customers. We can guess and we can be less wrong and we can get closer to each moment of truth or at placing people in a segment or whatever. But basically we never really know. So where are the holes in this? Which kind of data would you wish that you had?
I mean, you're never going to get a perfect data. And again, with things happening around privacy, I'm not sure that it's going to get much better. It's not really challenging. So, and like you're saying, no matter what data you capture, you don't know what mindset necessarily the customer is in when they're transacting with you. They don't, you don't know if they've just been in a big fight and is accessing your website.
Yeah. So their mood.
A French phone or whatever. It's impossible to get full information. But I think the good thing here is it's also not needed. Oftentimes in personalization, the chances, like you're saying, people ask, oh, you don't have this information, we don't have that information, we don't fully know. And I say no, but you know what? It's better than nothing. Again, what is actually the alternative here? The alternative is no data. It's our gut feeling. It's giving everyone the same. So as long as you're a bit better than nothing, and you can A-B test that with statistical significance, you're doing fine. So that's really it. Just the information around what customers are buying that I think almost that most customers, most companies could get access to in one way or the other, you know, combined with different machine learning techniques and different algos, you know, you can do better than if you didn't do anything. That's relatively cheap and easy to start off with.
I remember discussing with one of your colleagues the scenario of gifting. And as I understood, you have this segment called gifters, mostly men in particular, looking to buy a gift. I would expect them to have a fairly high conversion rate as well, because they just want to get it over with. I mean, I could fall in that trap at least.
In the industry overall, the jewelry industry, the majority of it is gifting. Around 70%. We over-index slightly on self-purchasing, so we have a slightly lower share of gifting than the industry, but it's still the majority of our sales, let's say. Of course, that gifting both includes many different gifting occasions, the majority of that, if you double-click on that, is male-to-female gifting. And if you look at that, you find that by far the majority of that gifting is what we call hinted or heavily hinted, meaning that the female in that relationship have either said, I want something with this brand, or she's just sent a link directly with the product that she wants the person to buy for them. So that means that it's the end user that's driving the demand for us and that we want to communicate primarily towards. That
doesn't probably having course, an idea of who's related to whom could, I mean, that could be an interesting data point have.
Also something we are discussing. Right, so it's quite important for us to get information around the gift receiver and not just the customer that's actually transacting in the channel, but who's actually receiving it.
Who broke up, who got a new girlfriend, boyfriend.
Sure. Yeah. All of those things are occasions where you would normally buy, you could buy jewelry. It's information that is of course, to some degree, valuable. So where was I going with this? Sorry, I just lost my train.
I was happy because I kind of got the question answered, or at least I think I did, about the holes that could be in your data capture, because I just realized how fantastic a data point it would be if you knew who was in and out of relationships and super private data and probably hard to catch. Thinking back at the old Facebook days where it was, you could have a relationship status, it's complicated, or in a relationship and people would like probably get out. But that would be interesting. Do you think that you're better off at Pandora than many others in terms of getting this rich data set and being able to calculate the insights?
Again, it depends a little bit on who you compare up against. If you look at the jewelry industry overall, the jewelry industry in general is relatively immature. The reason is actually that it's so fragmented. You don't have a lot of huge jewelry brand, and most of them that you have are operating mainly in one or, let's say, a few markets. There aren't that many truly global big jewelry brands. And to build up this data, to have a team of data scientists sitting and crunching it, and to invest in proper technology and talent to drive this agenda, you do need some scale behind it. So let's say overall in the industry, we benchmark ourselves constantly. I believe we are doing very well, which is also why we are comparing ourselves more up against what we call specialty retail, which also includes things like cosmetics, where some companies are, of course, very advanced.
Yeah, beauty and health. Yeah, so I had actually Peter Anders Frank from Matas joining a previous episode of this, and they are super advanced.
They're known for this, right? So
that's Brendan winning almost kind of every award there is. Yeah. But looking at the marketing that Pandora is currently doing, from like A to C, which part would you regard as the highest personalized part?
Yeah. So again, when we started off this journey now a few years back, we wanted to make sure that we were executing some use cases that drove some value early on, while we at the same time were sort of building the foundation for doing more advanced use cases later on. So the first use cases we identified were, this is now a few years ago, were mainly sort of focused in specific channels. So we said, let's wait, we're doing some of the more fancy stuff. Let's just try and see how good can we actually get an email as a channel. It's an easy channel to start with. We have a bunch of good data. There's a bunch of great tools. We also have a super strong team internally in Pandora that was ready to catch this agenda and drive it. So that's where we were by far the most advanced to begin with. We also very early on started doing more and more relatively advanced targeting, let's say at least having some thinking around how we were doing our targeting efforts. And not necessarily one-to-one.
So targeting in advertising.
In paid. In paid. And there again, we saw quite a great return because as Pandora, we are spending a lot of money on paid media. We are spending more than 2 billion Danish kroner every year. So getting a small improvement in how we are spending that money, of course.
Excluding people who just bought and stuff like that, probably.
Pays itself back very, very fast, let's say. So that was some amazing quick wins, and that really drove, some buy-in from the rest of the organization in that this can actually be done. And then we started unlocking now, some time ago, then the next chapter that we call Personalization 2.0. We were trying to then focus on saying, how can we then take the next step in driving a better omni-channel, cross-channel experience for our customers? But that was how we started.
Okay. And which I think which part now, if you look at what is there now, which part is most personalized? Can you say that? It's not the branding part. I think we ruled that out. But is it close to the moment of conversion, or is it in the inspiration part, or which part of the customer journey?
The funnel. So I'm going to answer it a little bit differently. So in that first phase, we focused on, as I said, the different channels and tried to see how mature could you get each of them. When we needed to then take the next step to personalization 2.0, we took another approach. We didn't split it out by funnel step or by channel. Instead, we said, okay, let's really identify one of our markets actually and see if we can step change the overall level of personalization in that market. And we've been working very closely with our UK as the first pilot market. And the reason why we took that approach is that we found that it actually requires quite a lot of work locally. Now, I'm sitting in the headquarters, but there's a large amount of work needed at the local level to successfully deploy these strategies. And you need to be agile. You need to be fast to respond. You need somebody that sits and looks at this and optimizes it on an ongoing basis. And in our operating model, at least, that happens to a large degree locally. So we've spent a lot of time with our team there in working very closely on enabling them, seeing what are their needs and what are the use cases that we can make them succeed with in order to become even more advanced. And it's basically that program that we are now rolling out to all of our other markets across the world as well. So again, it's not a specific funnel step. It's not a specific channel. It's sort of all of it at the same time because we're trying to take a use case approach. A use case could be email gifters. How can we give them a better experience? But that will be in specific channels. It'll be in specific steps. Next one could be gold buyers. How can we give them an even better experience? So the use case methodology that we are deploying is based on a customer-centric approach. So where you see the differentiation is more in between our different markets, I would say, in terms of level of maturity.
Interesting. Okay, so the next question would be which parts are you most proud of? But I think maybe you already did answer that, or did you? What you're achieving within personalization in the UK sounds like. I mean, since you're rolling it out, I would assume that it's a success.
Well, definitely. But what I'm the most proud of it is easy to answer. But that is definitely building up the team. that we have and the level of talent that we have in our team. Technologies will change in the future. You know, strategies will change in the future. Our approach might change, but the team hopefully will not change, at least not too much. So building up a solid base of the right capabilities and having such a great team is what I'm the most proud of.
Fantastic. Yeah. Right. So summing it up, I think you mentioned we're talking about the stuff that you need to fix as a company before really doubling down on personalization. Mm-hmm. And I think one of your messages was that you need to have like the backbone machinery working first. You need to have like if the commerce is broken, then fix that. And
to a degree, right? It needs to be good enough. I just wanted to make that point clear. I think one of the mistakes that some companies have done, at least in the past, is actually saying, oh shit, we first need to fix our MarTech. We first need to fix our data. We first need to have the solid backbone before we can get going. Yeah. And you end up investing hundreds of millions, potentially at least. To get that going, and you don't drive any value, you lose momentum, you never get the change implemented. So yes, you're right, you need to of course have, let's say, a basic level of capabilities in those areas.
Right, you can also start too late.
Yes.
I mean, as long as it's good enough, then you sort of can take the next step. We were talking about branding.
For me, that's a more important point, actually.
And I think it's a really good point, especially if you then think in from the get-go, okay, first of all, do we have a known brand? Are we getting any traffic? Is there, and then think about how do we build up the data and how do we make sure that we have the right data and that we have enough of it?
Yeah.
And then have the right team to actually turn that together with technology into a more personalized experience. That's sort of what I heard you say.
Yeah.
So final question, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Pandora, but it's more on a personal level. Yeah. Jesper, what's your own favorite example of personalization that you've experienced as a customer?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think this will be a potentially bad example because it's not very scalable. I buy the majority of my clothes in a very specific clothing store in Copenhagen. And every time I go in there, the people that are working there, the owners greet me by my name, say, hi, Jesper, how's it going?
Hello, first name.
It's that simple. And that is sort of human connection that I'm getting there is very, very difficult to replicate in an online environment. No, people are trying and we're doing our best, and some people are doing great things, including Pandora. Mm-hmm. But that human connection, I still think, is somewhat difficult to replicate that I get in my favorite clothing store here in Copenhagen.
Yeah. I think you're right. And especially thinking about a future where more and more will be handled by AI to some extent and to generative AI, I think we'll become really, really razor sharp at distinguishing between whether we're interacting with an AI or with a real person. And even though the AI might in some places, you know, serve me better on a sort of a logical level, I'd really like the warmth and the gratitude and the personalized interactions.
And so, I think that's definitely it. So shout out to Goods in Copenhagen. I think they're doing a great job, even though it's one store.
I guess that was the store, actually.
It's difficult. But I do think, on the other hand, you know, some of where you get closer, sort of at a more scalable level, is probably some of the VIP programs as well.
Yeah.
I also fly a lot with SAS and get this annual letter from the CEO and things like that, which is also quite nice for them to do. I know they get a lot of bad press, of course, but I do find that valuable. They also greet me by name, of course, when I answer the plane and things like that. So it's that, again, personal human level. Like you're saying, one of the areas I find very interesting is actually how can we get close to that in an online environment? Is that possible? We are investing quite a lot of money as well in Pandora, in AI and also Gen AI, but also, let's say, AI in a broader agenda, to try and see how we can replicate that magic that happens in a physical store online, especially because our product requires quite a lot of engagement. It's not that we're just selling a ring, right? We're selling a meaningful ring. So we need to understand you as a customer in order to do that. So yeah, we are trying to see what we can do. I know many other companies are as well. I do think Gen AI opens opportunities, but at the same time, you know, the technology is amazing, but you can oftentimes, I think, see that somebody has written their LinkedIn post using ChatGPT. It's not fully there yet.
Quite often you can tell. Yeah. Why else would you have expressed your new client win as a poem? I mean, come on. I know that you didn't write that by yourself. Yeah. So
the opportunity is definitely there. And that's one of the things I'm excited about in the future as well.
Yeah. And I was speaking at a conference about personalization and AI, and a lot of other people, other speakers were talking about how AI would, generative AI would affect their specific discipline. And a girl called Christina was talking about how it would affect design. And she said, you know, an AI is not going to take the designer's job. Another designer using AI will. Mm-hmm. So it's really what we make of it.
Yeah, so that's a good point. The other thing, of course, that I'm very focused on is what can we drive as differentiators at Pandora? Everybody has access into the same LLM models, unless you build your own, which few companies, I guess, will end up doing. So what can truly differentiate you is the data and the training that you put into it and how you use it, like you're saying.
Yeah.
So again, that goes back to where we actually started this conversation. Yeah. I think that only points towards first-party data becoming an even bigger differentiator in the future, because it will allow potentially Pandora and other companies that invested a lot in this agenda to have a better better outcome of using some of the...
We have a client that is currently doing a pilot for having totally individualized Gen AI generated texts in their abandoned basket emails, for instance. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing the results of that. It's not too early. Maybe when this episode comes out, we'll have the results.
Okay.
Yes, but thank you so much for joining. Really interesting conversation. We could have gone on for hours.
Yeah.
But I think there's already enough content even for the long commute. Yeah. So so thank you very much for joining.
Thank you so much, Rasmus. It was a pleasure as well. And indeed, we could continue. So maybe we'll do that one day. But
let's do that. I'll meet you in goods and we can buy some of the same sweaters. And for the audience, thank you for listening in on this. And thank you for following the podcast. And if you're not subscribing to it already, please do in your favorite podcast tool. Remember that all the illustrations and even a written abstract of the book can be downloaded at omnichannelinstitute.com/resources, where you can find all these things. So thank you and have a nice day.
Thank you for listening in on this episode of Hello First Name. Remember that all models and even a written abstract of the book are available for download. You'll find the link in the show notes.
In our next episode, which is a classical audiobook chapter, we'll be listening to Chapter 16, Data and Personalization, with data obviously being a prerequisite for getting the insights ready for personalization. How do you know when you have enough or when it's good enough?